In this episode of Te Pātaka Toi Adam Art Gallery's podcast, we hear Professor Maria Barge in conversation with artist Matthew Galloway. This is a recording of the lunchtime talk titled Finding Ways Forward that took place on Wednesday, 5th of June 2024, in conjunction with the exhibition Infrastructure, Power, Politics and Imagination. Maria Barge is Professor of Politics and Māori Studies at Te Heranga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, and Matthew Galloway has a research-based arts practice with an ongoing interest in renewable energy generation. Sitting amongst Matthew's immersive project titled The Power That Flows Through Us, Maria and Matthew explore contemporary perspectives on the politics of resource use with an eye on the past, present and future.
My name is Matthew Galloway. I wanted to start by giving a little bit of context to my thinking and how I guess I'm viewing the way that we want to talk today about big infrastructure projects, the way that they shape our notions of identity, and how they make us think about, I guess, just the world we live in. I've been interested in dams for a long time, and I think some of that just comes from living for most of my life down in Te Waipounamu and being surrounded by these massive hydro lakes, being part of families that would holiday at these lakes, and kind of just being in awe of the size of some of these dams that are quite out of our view if we don't live near them, but yet define so much of how we live in this modern world. In particular, the Clyde Dam that this project focuses on is interesting to me because it speaks to a moment in politics as well. It's a Think Big project, part of Robert Muldoon's national government's drive to make this country more self-sustaining at a point in the 1970s and 80s where there was a lot of global pressure and different I guess driving factors that led to these decisions to really kind of like go big with infrastructure. And the Clyde Dam, part of what's interesting to me is that it massively changed the landscape, created a huge hydro dam and hydro lake called Lake Dunstan, which flooded half of the town of Cromwell, which was a historic township, and led to residents of Cromwell having to be, given new parcels of land, shift their livelihoods, as well as creating this lake that over time has had ongoing environmental impacts on the landscape. So for me, part of this is about tracing political decisions from a while ago, some of which before my time, that still impact us today. And thinking about this whole notion of how we got to where we are and what can be achieved by taking time to sit and notice and think about the infrastructural landscapes that shape our modern world. So Maria, it's great to have you here and thanks so much for joining me. And I wanted to start off the back of that introduction just by asking if there were similar experiences in your own life in terms of whether it's a specific kind of moment of political decision making or an infrastructure that has shaped you in some way.
Oh, well, tuatahi, tēnā koutou katoa, kei te tautoko ngā mihi, koa mihia. Lovely to see you all here, and yeah, hopefully there's some good discussion. I find looking at the picture, I'm looking this way straight at the view, I find it quite upsetting to look, I find it quite emotional, but to look at the infrastructure, so I'm going to look away for the moment, and downstairs in particular where you have the swirling waters, I think, and you're sort of walking beside them, I find that particularly disturbing. And in part, that's because it's reminiscent of one of the significant pieces of infrastructure that's impacted, our family and our hapū, which is it's a spring. The spring hasn't impacted us. It's the loss of access to the spring, Karamu Tākena, which is based on the northern slopes in Rotorua. Lake Rotorua is there, and there are some hills called Te Heo Tonga, and the spring Karamu Tākena is there. And our hapū, I'm on that side of my family. The other side of my family are Barges. Donna Cross is my cousin who's here, based in the Wairarapa. But this is the Ngāti Kia, Ngāti Tuara side, the Māori side of my whakapapa. And there our hapū has lived for, you know, a very long, well, had lived for a very long time, using the water from the spring. There are significant sites on that range, Te Heo Tonga, Wahitapu. There's a pāpaiaka, different pā sites and cultivation areas, kāinga sites on that area. In fact, our Hapū Lands Trust continues to care for some of those lands. And it was only about 15 years ago when the trust began to pay for water, that we started to query why we were paying for water, and wasn't there a spring that was on our land here, and started doing some of the research into Karamu Tākena and how we had lost that spring. And the upsetting thing is, within our hapū there was a kind of silence around the topic, and through the generations there'd been I think a sense that maybe something untoward had gone on, and maybe members of our hapū, and here my great-grandfather was probably, there was some sense that maybe he was implicated in you know, something underhand that had occurred. And when we finally discovered and found the minutes of this meeting from 1954 between the Rotorua Borough Council and members of our hapū, including my great-grandfather, there was this, we found the kind of record of what had gone on at this sort of fateful meeting, where the hapū members, the council had said, we can take your spring, we need this water for the township of Rotorua. It now supplies 90% of the water for the Rotorua town supply. So it's a significant, you know, amount of water. They could see that. They needed the water. I said, so we can take it, or we could take it and give you some amount of money as acknowledgement that we're taking it off you. So what would you prefer? And so they had the minutes there. My great-grandfather says, well, we don't actually want to part with it. You know, he didn't speak English, so it would have all been translated. It's of great cultural and spiritual significance to us. And, you know, we're happy to share the water, happy to share the water with the people of Rotorua. We're happy to think about some sort of lease arrangement, but we don't want to lose the land here or our connection with this spring, which is precious to us. So the council members say again, well, we can take it. So we can take it, or we can take it and give you some amount of money. What do you prefer? And so it was quite stark, the sort of decision. And there was, for that initial taking, an amount of, I think they bargained them up to £250 at that time in 1954 that swapped hands. And I think from there, maybe within the hapū as well, there was a sense that, well, maybe someone sold it. And, you know, despite the record that we found. And so I think there was this kind of fear as well that someone had done something wrong. And so that created a kind of silence and shame that then came through the generations. But actually from that meeting, we can see that that wasn't the case. And after that, there were, over the years, further acres around the spring that were taken. So in the end, there was a 14-acre area that was taken, and the other pieces were taken under the Public Works Act without any compensation. But it was more the erasure as well of our kind of presence and connection to the place. The other key aspect that we found in the minutes of that 1954 meeting was that the council had agreed that we, as a hapū, could continue to access the spring, to visit it, and to continue to take water from it for our lands, which are right next door. And those aspects weren't transferred when the land was shifted into the ownership of the council. So again, our connection with the place was severed. And it was only, you know, when we went in more recent times looking through, and I guess this is part of, you know, this sort of infrastructure requires, I mean, this is small scale compared to this, but it still requires a fence, you know, so there's got to be a big fence to stop you getting in there. And, you know, looking through the fence at the water that comes through, you know, that's the kind of interaction that we'd had for many, many years. But I guess the hopeful aspect of it is in more recent times, in 2022, that it's after long discussion and engagement, the council agreed that actually they didn't now need to own the land per se to continue. We agreed to continue sharing the water as a hapū, so they did return the land to our hapū in terms of the ownership of it, and we agreed that we would continue to keep sharing the water from the spring for the Rotorua town supply. So, you know, there's a kind of pain and agony in the history of it, but also an indication that you can resolve an injustice like that. You can put these things right. And now we're in discussions about just having some kind of sign which indicates that, you know, our presence on the land, and that that was a site where we had kāinga and cultivation sites and pā and so on. So to kind of reintroduce our presence in the landscape and connection with the spring. And we've been, as a hapū, on a couple of trips now to the pump station, but also to visit the puna, the where the water comes out of the ground as well. And it's, you know, there's lots of tears. Everybody's quite upset about seeing it and being close to the spring again. So, yeah, there's that. I guess there are two, I won't go on too long, but no. two other big infrastructure, well, that was smaller scale, but infrastructure projects that I think about. The other one is down the road from where our hapū land is, which is about 10 minutes out of Rotorua, on the road towards Atiamuri, the Atiamuri Dam. But upstream, of course, is Ōrākei Korako and the Ōhakuri site in the Ōhaki marae that had to be relocated. And there, you know, that's a very upsetting story from 1961, where they had to move their marae, and they witnessed their houses, so they, the people were moved to Taupō, and there they had ngāwhā, you know, geothermal geysers and so on that were flooded by that dam, and they watched their houses get burnt down before they were relocated, and their marae was relocated. And the ngāwhā, those geysers, were flooded with water, so they could no longer come up. So again, even though I'm not particularly connected to that marae, but the thought of your geysers and you know, wāhi tapu being flooded like that, I think is also a kind of upsetting thought.
I think it speaks to a narrative that I know I've come across in my research into green energy and thinking about the idea that whenever we create energy, it it's only done through some kind of energy being put in. You know, you have to put energy in to get energy out. You have to sacrifice something in order to create something. And often we see these infrastructure projects happening in land that has been deemed
sacrificable.
Yeah, sacrificable. and often that equals indigenous lands, and I guess in the case of the Clyde Dam, a space that's well outside of the line of sight of most of us living, especially in the cities. And I think in particular, some of what you've just talked about also points to a conversation I had in the newspaper, which everyone can feel free to take away with them, with Komatoa of Otago Marae, Edward Allison, down on Otago Peninsula. We talked about original plans for the Clyde Dam as part of the Think Big project to power a new or second aluminium smelter. So there's Te Wai Point right down in bottom of the South Island. that is powered by Manapouri Dam. And the idea was to build a second one on the Aromoana spit on Otago Peninsula. And that particular infrastructure project never went ahead. And part of that was because of really strong public protest and opposition to the changing of that landscape. And in particular, Edward talks about Otago Marae being a meeting place for both Māori activism and environmental activists to come together. And it's kind of, again, I guess a hopeful story about this idea of coalescing around a big opposition to something that is happening. And I was wondering how you have experienced similar stories in terms of like a convergence of environmentalism and Tau Māori, you know, ways of seeing the world.
Well, I think we're in a prime situation now with the war on nature that's occurring. And what I heard Tipine O'Regan describe the other day as the Ram Raid Bill, which he meant the fast track legislation. But I thought Ram Raid was actually pretty apt for what's occurring. And I think, the way I see that as well is that these sorts of attacks are attacks on nature, the environment, and also our connections and our relationships across us as communities. You know, our ability to have trusting, positive relationships across our community is impacted when we're kind of threatened with these sorts of ram raid tactics and removing all of the checks and balances that we've struggled to put in place over the years, whether those are the checks and balances for environmental impacts. And so thinking of we're about to see the return of, poor old cows having the winter grazing and so on, and being able to go through the waterways. So those checks and balances, but also the checks and balances that have come as a result of many decades of struggle from Māori as well to have recognition of our voices and our rights with these special places, but also, more broadly our political rights. So, yeah, I think we are all impacted, and the counter kind of to that is us all working together. So I look around on projects that are that sacrifice less, and that we get a say in determining what is sacrificed. And here I kind of think of a much smaller project, in fact a micro project behind our marae at Kiaroa at Horohoro, which is 10 minutes out of town. We have a micro hydro which generates electricity mostly for just the marae when it's turned on properly. But anyway, repairs and maintenance aside, but there we're only sacrificing a maximum of 10 metres of water of the flow. It's such a small scale that, the sacrifice is determined by us and deemed to be bearable. Tuna and so on can continue to swim in the main part of the river, go down the waterfall and so on. But it's having, being able to be part of those decisions and, weighing up what is the sort of scale that we're prepared to accept of the sacrifice and the inputs. Mm. And I think that's kind of crucial. I guess the other thing, since we're talking about renewable energy as well, is now the shift in focus to looking for minerals as part of that. And again, in our area, it was with a sense of dread that I looked at the map of lithium across the country. And unfortunately, we've got a little ground dot, a green dot on in our area. There's a few green dots of lithium potential in the Taupō volcanic zone. And again, that's another set of processes that are mostly taken outside our ability to impact them. We have had a small win in a change to the purpose of the Crown Minerals Act to insert the word manage instead of promote for the whole regime, that instead of promoting prospecting, exploration and mining, those working under the Crown Minerals Act now just manage the process. And I think that's quite a big shift, but the demand for lithium and batteries and so on continues to kind of ramp these things up. And again, it's not that we don't necessarily want batteries. Of course, we're going to need batteries to store some of our electricity, but it's that having a say in the decisions about what we use the electricity for. Is it, you know, an aluminium smelter a good idea? Is it, you know, making all these sort of plastic trinkets a good idea? Or do we want to save it to use that electricity for something very carefully considered? Mm. And that's, again, back to, you know, a say in those decisions.
And it also speaks to me about this idea, which is not an easy, I don't think there's no easy answer to this, but, you know, you would say some environmental groups or attitudes would be towards degrowth, and at the same time, if you think about the idea of iwi being given more sovereignty and ability to access resource and think about being enterprising, do you see that as being a difficult kind of, I don't know, tightrope to walk in terms of how to move forward?
Maybe. I guess we haven't seen that so much here. I mean, internationally, we can look at Canada and we can see there that a lot of the environmental groups are wanting the Indigenous peoples to get out of the way of, you know, the access and extraction of the lithium. So you've got a different sort of conundrum going on there, which we may see here, or I'm not sure. We haven't had the same, although I heard Shane Jones use the phrase critical minerals, but we haven't heard a lot about these sorts of minerals as critical minerals, you know, for national security, kind of bound up in everything that gets packaged with. But we do have other examples where these things have come into tension. And I think if you look at Tūruwera, for example, where Tūhoe have a particular way of seeing their project for Manamotuhake with the Tūruwera area. And that is quite different from a DOC way of looking at conservation, picking particular species and trying to put all effort you can into protecting that one species, whereas Tūhoe are looking much more at reconnecting with their own lands and waterways and knowledge that goes with it. So I think those things can come into tension. I think there are easy ways, I think, of slipping into binaries when we start to think about some of these things. And you're right, it's never easy.
Mm. One thing that I think I was interested in, and you know, linking back to my research into Think Big and this moment in our politics where MMP didn't exist yet, the Muldoon government came in with a lot of power and exercised it to the level where with the dam, for instance, they were actually not given the right to use the water in this way. They weren't given permission to do so. The Supreme Court or the High Court stopped them from doing it. And they passed a bill to go over the top of that and do it anyway. And there's aspects of that that make me think about where we are now with the fast track bills and things like that. But I was wondering, I guess, you know, what it really shone a light on for me was just the lack of consultation at all at that point with any kind of community, let alone with Māori. But I wondered how that has changed over time and where we are now with that as a sign of progress. Or not?
Well, I think in the intervening years we've seen change. I don't know if I'd use the word progress, but, you know, shared authority examples are much more common. We've got, you know, co-governance of the Waikato River. We have all around the country examples where councils and community groups, you know, Te Awa Tupua includes fish and game, as well as, you know, mayors and councils and iwi representatives setting the strategy for the Whanganui River. You know, so we have a lot of those examples around the country, and I think those are positive, showing how we can have good connections amongst ourselves and we can share authority, and it does make sense to have the relevant people sitting around the table making decisions about things. But we can also see in particular when I'm thinking about Māori rights right now. We were talking about, you know, possible treaty principles bill on the near horizon, you know, that actually our rights still aren't well protected in our constitutional arrangements, and they should be. Mm. So that does mean that if there's a determined government, they can, you know, trample over decades of hard work of all of our communities to do things well for the environment, for each other. So that's where, you know, I guess the checks and balances need to be reintroduced. But again, when you have a government that's already so effective and dominant in this way, it comes back to, I guess, our other strategies that we have as people, as communities, to mobilise for action and things. Mm.
I think I was reading about the lithium situation and some of Shane Jones, you know, the work that he's doing to kind of push things through. And one interesting thing that I read was, even though he's trying to cut through a lot of red tape to get mining happening or to start that kind of progress up again, the timeline of exploration and digging and figuring out how to extract these minerals will take long enough that it's unclear whether enough progress can be made, even with these fast tracks, before a different government with a different mandate might come in and shut it down. So that was interesting to me as well. And I guess it speaks to both sides of the coin of how tough it can be to make progress either way within these kind of truncated terms. And in particular, I guess when you have a government that comes in with a really strong change of course, like we're experiencing at the moment as well.
Yeah, Jane Kelsey actually had a piece the other day, week, in The Conversation about some of the advice that Shane Jones has sought around being able to try to bind future governments for the sorts of ideas that he has. Mm. And I think, you know, when we have had experience with that, with international trade agreements, some future governments are bound by, you know, particular aspects of those. And that is quite dangerous, I think, and fetters the sovereignty of our government in ways that they're not prepared to fetter it, for example, to communities or Māori. I think the fact that he sought that advice should make us a bit wary of, as you say, trying to ensure that it's locked in across different governments, which means locking it in across what communities might, you know, want to have a say in. It does take some time. I mean, the other aspect to this is the kind of economics of it as well, thinking about those companies, particularly in the mining sector, that you know, tend to talk up their potential. And I know the Trans-Tasman Resources Limited, that when they were kind of invited to be part of, you know, the fast track application process, they were very public about that, to try and increase their fortunes on the stock exchange. And I think so some of these companies have other games at play as well. So sometimes it is difficult to determine how serious they are about, you know, the mining aspect versus the trading money and kind of a casino capitalism type environment. Mm. Mm.
Another essay that's in the newspaper, Tina Nata writes about Waimari, this idea of the whakapapa of water, stewardship of water, personhood, giving personhood to awa, to mountains. Have you seen that having an impact on policy in a way where, you know, we're kind of coming around to a different way of seeing these resources and these landscapes?
Yes, but I think the amendments relating to fresh water, to Manawa Te Wai have just gone to, been introduced. I'm not sure which, I suppose the, I think they weren't going to the Environment Select Committee because it had too much work on. But so the new hierarchy of obligations relating to fresh water that, again, weren't just Māori, but other experts, freshwater ecologists, Mike Joy and others, who kind of really fought hard to get the prioritisation of the water itself and its own ecosystem kind of elevated in that hierarchy, now looks, all of that work looks like it's about to be swept away by the government. So, yeah, yes, good, but...
Just scary how quickly
reversals can happen. And in terms of the legal personhood for a mountain, you know, Te Uruwera or Taranaki Maunga, if that still goes through, and Te Awatupua, those are good sort of steps, I think, from a Māori perspective into recognising the mana of those entities. But at the same time, it is still not quite, not quite like for Te Uruwera, they, Tūhoe will talk about, you know, mana mo te hake as a, in Te Kawa o Te Uruwera is, you know, it really, rather than this particular Western notion of legal personhood, even though that is an innovation as well. I think what you're saying, you know, in Tina's piece, she talked about the whakapapa of water. And again, for minerals, I think that's an important conversation to continue as well, that lithium, for example, does have a whakapapa, interesting, related to freshwater and parawhenua mea, and you know, different aspects of that that whakapapa that Tina talked about. So they're all kind of cousins, you know, the types of rock and minerals and the different types of aspects of water, water on land, water, you know. So I think that again gives you a sense of that relational picture where, you know, unlike what the mining companies say, that it has no value until it's extracted out of the ground, it actually does still have value. It has a family and cousins and, you know, relationships, and we are connected to those things as well, and have an obligation to care for those relationships that we have. Doesn't mean they can't become unbalanced, you know, out of balance, but you then need to be careful about how you rebalance any of those things. So if you're going to extract something, think again about the scale and the sacrifice and the intent for those things.
It's interesting how we can place so much certain values on a type of resource. So for instance, the idea of, you know, almost subconsciously thinking of oil as kind of damaging and bad, when it's not, you know, like oil is a natural resource. It is of the earth. It's created through natural processes, and it's simply about the way we extract it and the damage we allow it to do, and the unsafe ways in which we allow it to propagate. That is kind of, I don't know, it's just an interesting perspective to think about, in the same way that I look at the swirling water of the work downstairs as the water kind of being confused because it got turned into a lake, and then it went through these turbines, and then it's turning back into a river again. But yeah, I also just see it as, I guess we're kind of conditioned to see it as clean, you know. I don't know if I'm really making sense. But
clean energy.
Yeah. I wonder, maybe if we finish and we can have questions in a moment, but if there was any projects you were aware of or involved in that give you hope for the future of some of these conversations.
Oh, well, many, I think. You know, lots of the things we're doing at the hapu level now to think, you know, make our plan for the water, even though we've agreed to continue to share it with the township of Rotorua, we're also thinking, actually, you know, we'd like to test it, the quality and the flow, you know, along. So the reconnecting of the people with the place and the water itself, I think, is really positive. But I think there are also lots of stories and examples around the country where cool things are happening, communities are working together. I do have one favourite, which, because I just think it's so perfectly depicts the kind of change that I hope we continue to see, which is up in Auckland. Ngāti Whātua or Rākei as part of getting some of their land returned in their settlement. There's an area called Pōrewa Recreation Reserve, and it was a pony club. And, you know, so you think ponies and people trotting around on ponies. And then it was, but when they had it returned, they converted into gardens. So you can, there's a veggie garden, there's a rongoā, a medicine garden. They have native plant plantings. People, Aucklanders, can continue to access it, go walk through it, and they can get veggies. If they, anyone who wants green veggies can go to the site. So, you know, there was a huge injustice for Ngāti Whātua. When they had it returned, they generously again shared it again with all of Aucklanders. And I think remembering stories like that is important for us as we all kind of come under attack in this current government and direction, that actually, you know, these things, we can resolve some of these things and rebalance where there's been an injustice, and we can all work together. And I guess as part of that is some of the thinking around Te Tiriti as our kind of blueprint. It did provide us all a space and a place here. Yeah, so those are the examples that keep me hopeful.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, I mean, for me as well, read something like Tina's essay and the idea of the whakapapa of water, that's been quite a, I guess, transformative thought for me as well, in terms of just, I guess, deepening and widening how we understand our connection to our landscapes. And yeah, and I think if you can have those deeper connections or think in these wider ways, it does change maybe our collective consciousness around what it means to take and put back. Which is maybe similar to that story. Yeah, maybe as a last point, what this has made me think is that, yeah, trying to have confidence to harness the power that we have individually and then as a kind of, as groups, is so important. And I don't know, I mean, I feel like I struggle with that in terms of, you know, just, I don't know if it's the confidence to do so or the feeling that someone else is more of an expert or a better place to speak, or and maybe that sometimes creates a condition where everyone's looking at each other to see who is going to, you know, stand up or who's going to find a way to get together. Yeah, and so trying to remember the agency, or trying to find the agency that we all have as well.
Yeah, it's probably a reflection of some decades of neoliberal policies trying to force us to think that we're just selfish, you know, self-maximizing rational men, which not all of us are, you know, and that actually we are a community as well, and we do have our relationships, and so it's us to stand together.
Kia ora, thanks everyone.
Yeah, thank you for coming.